It's the Skeptical Paternalism edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, seeing scorpions, pirate church, Wakefield Follies, sex Scientology, and skepticism, is it too paternalistic? Let's start episode 150.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Dawn, your political science philosopher.
Hi, everybody. Jenna, your biochemist.
You know, Jenna,
yes?
I was listening to the news lately, and I think you biochemists, you're just the most evilest people in the world.
Why?
Not you personally. I mean, you're one of the good ones. But I was listening to a lot of...
You make such assumptions.
I've been listening to a lot of debate that's been going on in the science and science news community about some research that was going on, funded by the American government in the United States and in Holland, I believe, where they were doing some research into the bird flu virus H5N1 in ferrets. And they, through their research, they created a version of this virus, which isn't normally communicable through the air. They made it communicable through the air, so you could kill a ferret at 50 feet away sort of thing with another sick ferret.
Or probably by sticking the ferret in an aerosol exposure chamber, but continue.
Yes. Well, they actually said that they have ferret in one cage and a ferret in another cage. They didn't mention anything about grinding them up and making an aerosol out of it, but but the point being is that these researchers, being your good scientist, had this great research and they wanted to publish it in Nature and another magazine, which name escapes me. Then they got sort of a knock on the door and saying, hey, from the American government saying, you know, actually, we thought about it, and this parts of this research you really shouldn't publish because it does have the potential to be a bioterror-type weapon. And currently, from what I understand, and I've heard this from a number of reputable sources, that there's negotiations going on as to how to word the scientific article. Everyone sort of says, yes, we should publish this work, but we don't want to publish the details so that it can be replicated by just anybody who reads the magazine. They're also saying that they want to make it so that select scientists will be able to see the whole thing so that you can replicate and the process of science can continue. They're not trying to put a lid on everything about this.
Well, for sure. And it seems like there's a bunch of issues with this, and one of them is what you sort of touched on, the last thing that you... I mean, to be able to publish something in a peer-reviewed journal... And not even, I was going to say ideally, but not even ideally, like at the bare minimum, it should have enough information to be repeatable. Otherwise, all scientists could just make up all the bunk that they want and publish it in Nature, which I'm sure is the dearest ambition of many grad students that are, you know, around the world. So the ability to have the research replicated is sort of a condition of it being published, especially in such a prestigious journal. One of the second issue, which I think is easier for me to deal with at least than the third, is who is funding this research?
From what I understand, it's the United States National Department of Disease. It's not the CDC, but it's more of one of the military... Again, this has been the hyperbole, but people say it's sort of the military branch of the CDC. Mm. That being said, it is just a department within the government that isn't the CDC, but does research into disease.
So the reason that I ask is because there actually can be agreements between funding parties and research parties about publication rights and what is and is not allowed to be published and who has to sign off on things that are published from different funding sources. So, for example, much of the basic research, I shouldn't say most because I don't know the statistics, but much of the basic research that goes on in Canada is funded by either CIHR, which is the Canadian Institute for Health Research, or NSERC, the National Science and Engineering Research Council, all of which is public funding. And so you don't have those kind of rules with that funding. It's understood that, you know, you're granted some money to do some research. You do the best research you can, and you publish the research that you have. And you don't have to ask CIHR for permission to publish. However, for certain private funding companies, there are some more complicated agreements between who has to sign off on publishing rights.
On this note, then, so, but if the money was given by, let's say, CSIS to do research into decoding airwave communications or decrypting something that CSIS would have a vested interest in, it is still part of the government. Would that, I mean, and this is more your opinion. I mean, legally, who knows? It depends on what was signed at the time.
Well, and I think that's sort of the crux of what I'm trying to get at, is it does depend on what was signed at the time, how egregious this is. The third point that I was going to make is getting more into the moral implications of things as far as what information should and shouldn't be, in the first place, found out, and in the second place, made public.
And I think that's one of the big issues, and I guess if we put aside as to was this ethical research in itself, as in did the government try and do biological warfare research under the guise of real research, we'll assume for the moment everyone was above board in doing this. But it seems that they have created something that has the potential to be quite a bad thing. I mean, this H5N1 has, depending on who you listen to, about a 50% fatality rate in humans. Right now, it's not very bad in humans because the only way you can get it is if you have intimate relations with chickens or some fowl like that.
I think you're starting to propagate an enormous prejudice against anyone who has actually contracted this disease.
Well, as me and Dom were discussing before the show, the fact that you have to have very close relations with the chicken generally makes most of us fairly safe.
Exactly. I mean, again, and by close relations, no, I don't mean intimate relations, although I guess it's intimate for the chicken because they, well, chickens don't have a lot of privacy on a farm.
True but, that. They but also I, only have one piece of genitalia.
Do they share it? no, so I mean, I just mean, like, people who run chicken coops, chicken farms, those people who have daily contact with it, who may get a scratch, and through that scratch, inadvertently, they can get the infection. But the point being is that this does have the potential to be replicated, obviously, because it's science, and as you point out, the point of science is to replicate results. But if I am some sort of...
We usually say reproduce, but that's okay.
If I'm some sort of right-wing nut job from Dakota or something who says, you know, the way I'm going to bring about the next world government, the libertarian utopia I want, is I'm going to replicate this results, spread this virus throughout the entire population, and kill everyone. That would strike me as being a slightly bad thing.
Well, and for sure. And, I mean, this probably merits a longer topic someday or another on the show. But as far as, you know, it's very hard for us humans to figure out what the exact consequences of our actions are going to be, which I think we can all attest to in our daily lives. So we don't know what the consequences are going to be of hiding the information or of sharing the information. For example, in this particular example, if people with nefarious intent did manage to get their hands on the information, the government here seems to be assuming that the only way for them to do that is for it to be published in a reputable journal. Of course, those in the information gathering sort of sectors of the world will know that there are other ways of obtaining such information, whereas sharing the information to the wider scientific community, I'm assuming most of which do not have nefarious intent, it is also going to help to do things like get more people on board with developing vaccines and that kind of thing, and share the important information that's needed. You can't take away information once it's being created. So by limiting it, it's my personal opinion that you're also limiting the ability of science to mitigate any negative consequences of that action.
Well, we'll have to debate this in the future because clearly there's something here to be discussed.
Absolutely. Yep.
But we have a great show today. And understand that, Jenna, you have to tell us about scorpions.
Oh, do I ever have to tell you about scorpions? First off, I should have a little disclaimer that although I would not describe myself necessarily as an arachnophobic, because as I understand it, phobias have certain, designations that I might not have. I am not a fan of arachnids.
Does that have anything to do with Mountain Dew and finding one in a... Okay, sorry. Reference for our regular listeners, weirdness for our new listeners.
So have any of you, have either of you actually seen a live scorpion?
I've seen them in, like, you know...
Behind glass?
Yes.
I've seen them up close.
Yeah? Not behind glass?
When I was a kid, they had a person from the aquarium come into our classroom and
brought scorpions. God, and they brought people from the aquarium?
He held it by its stinger.
Yeah. I once did that when I had a few beer, which is the only way you're going to... It was a friend's pet. But they are supposed to live in the wild, where I grew up in the South Okanagan, which also, you know, created a lot of nightmares. But my most horrific experience with a scorpion was in Ghana. I was traveling for a while, and we're going into a little bar there, and there was this massive scorpion on the doorstep, and the proprietor of the establishment came out with a flip-flop and squashed it so it smashed into 1,000 pieces, and the tail was like sitting on the ground twitching. But this week I found out that aside from being wholly terrifying, scorpions might have some really interesting biology.
And actually, just to allay your fears, typically in nature, the smaller the adult, the more potent it is. So the big,
well, specifically the smaller the claws and the bigger the tail.
So
anyhow,
Did you have any trouble seeing the scorpion that was on the front of this?
Goodness, no. But we might have some questions about how the scorpions themselves see. What could make an arachnid even creepier than it already is? Well, how about if you took away its eyes and it can still see? So there's a new finding by a group at the University of Oklahoma who were apparently scorpion-friendly, and it suggests that in UV light, scorpions can actually use their body, their entire body, as a primitive eye to be able to navigate the world around them. So for a long time, scorpions have been known to have a special characteristic when it comes to UV light, which again is ultraviolet, and that's that they fluoresce. And this means that when you shine a light of one wavelength on them, which is in this case UV, they reflect light at a different wavelength, and this sort of gives the impression that they're glowing under that particular light because there's no ambient light of the same wavelength. So with scorpions, you shine them on this UV light, and then they sort of glow this bluey green. And this has been sort of a nifty way of finding them in the desert at night, which is how a lot of scorpion researchers do their work. And I also suspect it would be a really great way of checking for them hiding under your bed. But the purpose of behind the scorpion fluorescence wasn't really understood. People knew they did it, but not why. So the scientists in Oklahoma are proposing that the cuticle, or the outer layer of the scorpion exoskeleton, is also sensing the light as it transforms it into a different wavelength, and that this information could then be sent to the central nervous system, effectively turning the entire scorpion into a basic eye sensing UV light. So it's important to know, first off, that scorpions have a pretty automatic response to move away from light. They tend to, you know, go under rocks and stuff. So if you shine a light from a particular direction and the scorpion senses that light, it will move away from that direction. So that's the basis of their experiment. And if it can't sense any light, it pretty much stays still. So previous experiments of the scorpion eye specifically had shown that the eyes are sensitive primarily to green light and secondarily to UV light. So these scientists shined some light, green light and UV light, and found unexpectedly that even though the eye was more sensitive to the green, that the scorpions were more responsive to the UV light. So they figured, well, maybe it's sensing it with something other than the eye. So they decided to take the eyes out of the equation. And they put on these wee little foil eye shades on the scorpions so they wouldn't be able to sense light with their eyeballs.
Sorry, I'm just picturing little sunglasses.
I know.
For scorpions.
I just see the like wraparounds, you know. Anyhow, so the results were that the scorpions were still really sensitive to UV light, even without being able to use their eyes. So this finding that the scorpions don't need their eyes to detect light led the scientists to propose that the fluorescence of the scorpion is actually a byproduct of the detection of UV light. So this seems to me a reasonable hypothesis. Given that in order to transform light from one wavelength to another, as opposed to just reflecting it like non-fluorescent things do, some type of energy exchange needs to happen. So most of the time, this is electrons moving from one place to another in specific molecules. And then these types of signals can be used to sense the light. So, for example, in our eyes, exposure to light causes rearrangements of the electrons in the molecule retinal, which causes a structural change of the molecule, which causes a conformational change of the protein it's associated with, and a whole cascade that eventually leads to our brain perceiving the light. So it's not so much of a stretch to think that a fluorescent molecule in the outer layer of scorpions could result in a similar signal being transmitted to their more primitive brain. So if the whole cuticle of the animal can detect UV light, which is present at low levels from moonlight, then the scorpion could actually use this to find shelter. As if any part of the light were blocked, say, by a rock on its left, the animal could move in that direction.
Or an animal that wants to eat it.
Then it would be moving right under its feet. I don't know how quick they sense it.
Well, no, and it's probably one of those things that any great evolutionary development isn't always completely positive. There may be some negative.
And maybe there could be a scorpion eater that would evolve that would just sit there like a rock.
I can just imagine the flip-flops. Scorpion saw a big shadow, said, "Oh, great, I'm safe, squat."
Well, what this really made me think of, although, again, this would be probably more useful during the night than during the daytime when the eyes were more useful. But I wonder if, you know, the scorpion's aware of the experiment that they signed up for from these scientists carries a serious risk of skin cancer. Like you mentioned before, you know, you got your foil eye shades, your UV light. To me, totally sounds like a Scorpio tanning booth.
We'll go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Are you walking to class? Are you grabbing a coffee? Got lunch hour to kill? We invite you to fill the silence of your day with the sound of some live music. Music on the Mind? UBC's newest student concert initiative invites the School of Music out of the concert hall into the schoolyard. 10 concerts at 5 venues on one campus. Let's get music on the mind at UBC. For more information, visit ubcmusiconthemind.com. Sponsored by CITR Radio, Vancouver, BC.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So, Sweden apparently has just invented an entirely new religion. Sweden is known for its sort of anti-copyright sort of mentality. It's also big for patent review. Everyone knows it's the home of Pirate Bay. They have a political party called the Pirate Party, which again is intended for that.
And now, do they wear eye patches?
No, but apparently there is Pirate Day, but that's, I think, something different.
Totally. Arr.
Yeah. But now they have the Pirate Church. Okay, well, it's not actually called the Pirate Church, but the Church of Copy Meism, which is, yes, Copy Meism, but it's spelled with a K, so it's not, it's still pretty lame, but the dogma of the church, because, I mean, every church has to have dogma, otherwise it can't really be a religion, is that that copying itself is a sacred act, that to copy is to make yourself better and a more virtuous person. They also claim that communication is also virtuous, so you need to communicate and spread knowledge out. It does not miss the biggies, of course. I mean, it doesn't actually have any God. There is no heaven. Well, maybe, anyhow. The internet might be seen as some sort of transcendent space for them. But it's not, like, dogmatic in any sense. It doesn't make any supernatural claims, but it does have some holy symbols. Most notably, Control-C and Control-P, which, for those people who are more nerdy, is copy and paste. And, of course...
Is pasting holy, too?
Well, you have to copy, which is taking, and giving is the pasting part.
Gotcha.
So. And, of course, it has some sort of anti-religious symbols. The Control-U symbol, which, of course, is used for other religions, corporations, and governments, which, of course, are trying to control you.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a pun.
Wait, yeah. Do they have this in a Bible?
I went to their website, and I did a little bit of research, and then I went back to try and do some more research, and the website's been down. Because, again, this has hit the
internet. They're holy text.
Yeah, I know. Well, it hit the internet, and they've just been, I think they've been overwhelmed with too many hits. They claim to have 3,000 members, but this leads one to ask, how do you become a religion in Sweden? Copyism actually failed to gain this status earlier because apparently it lacked rituals. Oddly enough, there is a...
Dude, what the heck is copy-paste if not a ritual?
Well, yeah, you know, but it's rather indescript. Actually, it's odd that what is it in Sweden? They have the right for freedom, right? So, I mean, if you want to practice a religion, you want to claim to be a member of the church, you can do it without any sort of designation from the state. You don't need to be a religious person and get a approval. However, if you do get approval, you are entitled to some things like money in that, government aid, which apparently is largely spent on things like interfaith communications, that sort of thing. This is actually given out by the Ministry of Culture, and the actual disseminating arm is the Commission of State Grants to Religious Communities. One of the benefits to becoming an official religion in the Swedish system is you actually can get money taken off of your income tax. So when you have your income tax, you can say, well, I want to give an extra $100 and I want the government to give it to this particular church, and you have to be one of these churches for them to do that. So the government becomes essentially a financial distributor for the churches, which really alters your opinion, because I mean, Sweden's one of the Nordic countries. They're atheists. All of them are atheists. Why would they be such a hand-in-hand with religion this way? Another thing they get government grants. Grants will give them money for schools, for some of their going on. Of course, the Swedish way out of this, and to maintain their sort of atheistic, agnostic thing, is religion in Sweden is largely a social function. And I might point out the Church of Copernicus more than sort of highlights that this is not so much religion as we would think here in North America, but religion as you would think of it in, well, not religion, just social, historical culture. Oddly enough, when I did some more research, they actually do have some religious traditions that they're sort of emulating. Yes and no, I'm not going to say they're copying because that would just be too easy. That a lot of Hinduistic religions believe in the idea of, you know, giving and sharing, which is kind of part of what this idea is. And in fact, even the Christian faith has a big thing about sharing knowledge. It's one of its minor nowadays, but one of its major tenets. If anyone's ever heard of the parable about, you know, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach him to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. And again, this is the idea of taking patented information, how to fish, and letting anybody sort of have it because it should be free to everyone. Or at least, I think that's how the practitioners of piracy church members would put it. In Canada, of course, if you become a church, there's only really two big benefits. One, you get to be tax-free. You know, you become a non-profit. And two, and actually this is one I kind of made up, but I think it qualifies, you gain protection from hate crime. In order to be protected from hate crime, you have to be a member of a recognized group or religion. And if you become a religion and someone denigrates you because of that, then it becomes possible anyhow to be a hate crime. So it'd be really cool if this religion took off in Canada. Then whenever the government tried to prosecute you for copyright violation, you can say, listen, it's part of my religious freedom.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's on one hand, I think this is kind of funny. From the other hand, I think it's kind of like, it's sort of rubbing salt in what, you know, me as an atheist has been saying for so many years about organized religion, and that it's made up. And if we keep perpetuating this notion that if you call yourself a religion, you deserve special treatment, you're kind of perpetuating the sort of monstrosity that is organized religion.
Well, on the other hand, maybe it's sort of bringing it down from the inside, because, I mean, if this group is granted religious status and then maybe some other slightly more off-the-wall group is granted religious status, and then maybe more really boring group is created religious status, and then maybe somebody else is, maybe an individual is granted religious status, and you know, people just keep finding the loopholes. It's basically diluting the worth of that designation, and eventually going to erode the whole system that's in place to support it.
I think actually there's two main angles that they're going at here. A third one is what you guys have been talking about. Let's make fun of religion in itself. And oddly enough, I don't think that's one of their main tenets. I think one of them, in a very practical sense, is that places like Pirate Bay and all them are facing legal challenges all the time, and they need money to defend it. Because they become copernicanism has become a sort of an official religion, it potentially allows them to use the state apparatus as a means of collecting donations in order to help them maintain this. And I think the other angle they're going at is that, again, we think of religion in the Pope, Catholic Church, fundamentalist evangelicals in the States. But
well, that's one of the things we think religion is.
But in Europe, again, largely in the Nordic countries, but not exclusively, religion hasn't been a religious thing. It has been a cultural thing. Mm-hmm. And these people, I think, are trying to say, well, listen, you know, copying and sharing information is an important tradition. It's an important part of our social society that we should keep up, and that this is one way to maintain that tradition is to make it a religion in the cultural sense of the term.
Hmm. Yeah.
We'll have to keep our eye on this story.
Yes.
Well, Andrew Wakefield is back in the news. Cue the groans, yes. Actually, this is kind of a follow-up to something Jenna mentioned last week with regards to sort of the manufactured controversy over vaccines. Wakefield is the doctor who first started the suggestion that vaccinations, particularly the MMR vaccine, was causing health risks, eventually suggesting that autism was the result of the vaccine. Wakefield's original study, which was published in The Lancet, was retracted, although many skeptics would have liked to see it retracted a lot sooner.
A lot sooner.
Thank you. He was also officially disciplined for using fraudulent methods in his research. He had serious conflict of interest involving deals with legal firms who were suing drug companies, as well as very serious charges that he abused his authority and exposed children to unethical testing. The current bit of news is that Wakefield is now suing the editor-in-chief of the British medical journal, Fiona Godley, for defamation. The lawsuit also names British investigative journalist Brian Deer, who has covered the controversy over the measles, mumps, rubella vaccination over the last 10 or 12 years, however long it's been. And, so here he is lashing out at his so-called persecutors.
Well, and the persecutors, of course, were acting in response to some degree outside of the bad science in the fact that Wakefield's had a very negative effect on things like vaccination rates, which have been dropping around the world and has caused deaths, directly caused deaths.
The case has been filed in a Texas court, which is where Wakefield currently operates his business.
You probably don't know this, but I have to ask. What is his business? I mean, he's not a doctor anymore, is he?
I believe he runs a private clinic where he caters to the needs of pseudoscience and crazy people.
I think he's created a big enough group of people that distrust vaccines and think that he is God for bringing it to their doorstep, that he can pretty much charge people under whatever banner he chooses.
Well, I know a number of people who sort of gone through this sort of cycle that he's gone through come to a point where they no longer practice their original activity, whatever it was, but they go on like speaking tours where, again, they make a decent amount of profit from selling marginal books, from doing speeches, from selling DVDs, and again, they have a very good vested interest in maintaining controversies like this because it becomes their bread and butter. But I'm sure someone in our listening audience might be able to let us know what he actually does today.
Yeah, if they care enough to look it up. This isn't the first time Wakefield has sued Deer. He sued the journalist along with Channel 4 and 2020 Productions over a documentary on MMR in 2004. He later dropped the action and agreed to pay the legal costs. So he's kind of trigger-happy when it comes to lawyers. The BMJ has issued the following statement. The BMJ is on notice that Andrew Wakefield has issued defamation proceedings, not in London, as might be ordinarily expected, as concerns a predominantly English publication, but in Texas, USA, where he now lives. Following the findings of the British General Medical Council's Fitness to Practice panel and Mr. Wakefield's history of pursuing unfounded litigation, any action brought against the BMJ and Mr. Deer in London would have been immediately vulnerable to being struck out as an abuse of the process. Despite the findings of the GMC's Fitness to Practice panel and his co-authors having publicly retracted the causation interpretation put forward by the Lancet paper, it would appear from the claim filed at court that Mr. Wakefield still stands by the accuracy of the Lancet paper and his conclusion therein, thereby compounding his previously found misconduct. While we await formal service, unsurprisingly, the BMJ and Mr. Deer stand by the material published in the BMJ and their other statements and confirm that they have instructed lawyers to defend the claim vigorously. So, why is Wakefield pursuing such a motive? He's lost previous attempts to silence Deer and others who have rightly criticized his methods. And I found an interesting quote by Orak over at Respectful Insolence, and he said, "Whatever Wakefield's motivation, this move reeks of desperation. After all, if this was such an obvious libel, why did Wakefield wait nearly a full year after publication of Deer's BMJ articles until filing this lawsuit? In taking action, Wakefield is both demonstrating the characteristics of a crank, the need to silence using the courts rather than to refute using science, and showing just how far he's fallen. In any case, I highly doubt Brian Deere has anything to worry about, other than the irritation this might cause and whether the company providing his libel insurance will go all wobbly on him. After all, the truth is an absolute defense against libel.
Well, I think that it's really wonderful that this action is happening after the articles were actually published, that Mr. Deere took so long to put together, because it did take him about two years to put together the two articles that were published, was it last year, I think, in The Lancet? Investigatory articles into Andrew Wakefield's motivations.
Brian Deere one, he's been after him almost from day one. He's been there for a long time.
But he took some really good time and did some really good research to put together, as Ethan mentioned, these two articles that were recently published in The Lancet, looking into Andrew Wakefield's sort of financial situation as far as the MMR vaccine and that kind of thing goes. So I'm really glad that that has already been published after this, because those were really well put together pieces and also have a lot of really, really, really indictable information about Andrew Wakefield as far as, you know, the financial gain that he stood to experience through creating this panic.
Very damning.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, I mean, really, the feeling that I get from this is, I mean, Wakefield is a... I mean, it's hard to mince words when it comes to this man, but this legal action, I think, is just an example of what Oryk said, a desperate person who is clinging to the last little shred of self-respect he must have.
No, see, again, I'm going to take a slightly different angle, because I think professionally... I mean, he jumped the shark a long time ago. Mm. I think what this is attempting to do is for those people who are dogmatically anti-vaxxers to sit there and say, see, he sued, and it's all been a big conspiracy by the big medicine, big pharma and all that to suppress all this. And, you know, sure, his case got thrown out, but you know why it got thrown out. It wasn't because he was wrong. Because I remember I was hearing a bit about this recently, and they were talking how some of the evidence he's using is that other scientists that were original co-authors on the paper had said something like 2 months before it came out in The Lancet, and, you know, that this wasn't all concocted. But, I mean, it was all that sort of, you know, pulling at little hairs just so that you have enough doubt that I think his main audience, which, again, is not real medicine, not real medical journals, which I think, again, he can never recover his reputation that way, mm-hmm. but just to make sure that he can still publish this sort of crap to people who are dogmatically anti-vaxxers. So you can still have those people who keep re-justifying the reasons why vaccines are bad. Oh, if it's not this reason, then it's for that reason. If it's not for that reason, well, it must be this reason. And they keep moving the goalposts, right? It's a very classic technique. And he's just giving them one more tool in that arsenal.
Do you know, my dearest hope for this would be that it would go far enough that he would actually be able to be held criminally responsible for something in the suing action, mm-hmm. as opposed to, because the original action whatnot, like, no, there's not been any criminal action on that. So if he were able to do something just stupid enough to actually be charged criminally for something that he's doing to other people in all this aftermath, that would be real poetic justice. And not even justice, because justice doesn't even come close to it.
I think that's another reason why, though, he's suing in Texas or Louisiana states. The Americans are very litigious by nature, and there's been a lot of attempt to reform the system so that you can't do these kind of frivolous lawsuits. But it's almost impossible for him to be sued for anything, even if it is totally whack job sort of lawsuits.
Well, we'll see how this develops. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca. Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC.
It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
So we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Don,
I had this very, very interesting conversation with a friend of mine recently. You know, he's a good skeptic by and large, but every so often he says, you know, he listens to shows like ours, to other skeptical shows, and he just says, you know, sometimes it seems as if we are putting ourselves sort of on a high horse and telling everyone else, boy, you are so stupid, you should really be doing this, that this is bad for you and you shouldn't do it. It came across to him, in his own words, as very paternalistic.
Well, your friend clearly needs to go back to school and, you know, wise up. Seriously.
I know. Well, he just doesn't know how to take care of himself, and I've been trying to help him out. But, you know, children, you just, I mean...
All right, boys. I think your friend might have something of a point.
You know, I was sitting back because as good skeptics, and I mean, this has always been our sort of Achilles heel, is that we can't just dismiss things dogmatically. You have to sit back and say, okay, is there an argument here or isn't there? And I kind of was thinking, you know, it kind of depends on what area you're talking about. I think something like, for example, medicine, where you're dealing with the anti-vax movement, you're dealing with homeopathy. I think in those particular cases, when we deal with a topic, and assuming, of course, we are true to our own idea that we are using the best scientific evidence available, we are using good critical thinking skills, to sit back and say, listen, you're not vaccinating your child. That is bad. You should vaccinate your child in a most patronizing sort of manner. Mm-hmm. But I think if you go to something else, and I loathe to bring this up, but the cell phones or the Wi-Fi, the sort of health issues, which have been totally dismissed and there is no real risk there. But at the same time, if someone doesn't want to have Wi-Fi in their house, if they don't want to use a cell phone, I mean, do we really have sort of a right to tell them, well, you know, you're being stupid and you should really, you know, fix your right? It differs, I think, when it affects other people. So when you refuse to have Wi-Fi in a school, that's a slightly different argument. But, I don't know, those strike me as two very different kinds of times where one would be appropriate to be very paternalistic, the other more informative than paternalistic.
I think it's kind of a catch-22 because, on the one hand, we don't want to be the sort of you know, nannies who go around waving our finger at people, but we don't want to stay quiet either. We want to express ourselves, and, you know, the proponents of pseudoscience and woo and whatever kind of, you know, anti-skepticism is out there, they benefit when we're quiet. And I think to a certain extent, we have to be strident, if I can use that word, in our opinions, but not dogmatic in our rejection of new ideas.
I think it also comes across, too, and again, a debate had more than 1 billion times in the skeptic community, is the idea of soft pressure versus hard pressure, right? Mm-hmm. Do you sit there and do you go out, and when they're yelling that vaccines are killing people, do you go out and you yell back, no, it's not? Or do you sit there and you sort of subtly say, hey, you know, here's something you might find interesting in a very sort of soft pedal cell.
Well, and I think you're touching on something that can actually be considered a little bigger and more complex and more spectral in nature than this hard, soft sort of way that it is really often discussed in the skeptic community. And that's just the concept that we've talked about before in the context of scientific communication, of just effective communication, period. And I think a lot of the times that the vehemence and the dedication that's people feel, especially about topics that are, you know, affecting health of children and that kind of thing, can really obscure the goal of the actual communication. So you start to get into a state where you're sort of speaking to yourself past someone, as opposed to trying to develop a communication strategy that is most tailored to the person that you're communicating to. One of the problems that I think people come up against, especially when talking to fairly staunch opponents, is that in order to be able to talk to someone, you need to be able to recognize their point of view, not necessarily recognize their point of view as valid, but have an idea of their point of view that is closer to the idea that they have, so that you're able to understand them and then develop that strategy. And that can be really hard if you feel like you don't understand or have anything in common with the way someone else is thinking.
Actually, I think that's another point that you're kind of hinting at that is, I don't know if it's bad, but if you sit there and you're talking to someone and you say, listen, the world is round, and they say, no, it's flat. There's a certain way that, I mean, especially in the scientific areas, the medical areas, a number of the debates you have is there is a, this is right, and although you may be free to have your own opinion, it can only be a wrong opinion. I mean, a lot of the issues we talk about on the show fall into a much more fuzzier gray area. But a lot of times, again, like when you're dealing with anti-vax or you're dealing with some science issues, I mean, there is no gray area in the context of the debate. And you tend to come across as being, you know, oh, if you were only as smart as me, you would know this. When it's not so much that you're really coming across that way, it's the fact that there sometimes is a right and a wrong answer. And as Jenna was pointing out, that the real art is to understand how to make that point.
Well, getting onto that as well, I mean, I think that understanding the context of your conversation will greatly enhance your ability to not come across as paternalistic. Because, you know, we use terminology that to someone who's not versed in sort of the skeptic lingo is not going to grasp it in a way that's...
Jargon!
Thank you, Jenna. Bless you. But for instance, you know, when it comes to, say, debating the existence of UFOs, right, I might say something along the lines of, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Or I might mention how, you know, a mountain of anecdote does not equal data. I think these are fairly neutral suggestions. But to someone who's not versed in this, this might come across as very sort of irritating.
Absolutely, especially some of the things that, you know, approaching the skeptic community from an outsider's point of view, things like people naming logical fallacies in your face, not really something that's going to foster an effective communication.
That's a straw man. That's so much of a straw man.
But there are a lot of things that I think, again, with this whole, are you speaking with someone? Are you trying to convince them? Or are you just sort of spouting what you believe in someone's general direction and sort of shaming them for not picking it up?
Exactly.
And there's a knowledge gap when we're talking about what is good evidence for believing something.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us skeptics, science-educated people, will know things that, you know, eyewitness testimony is not reliable, that your personal experience is not reliable. And by no means am I suggesting to Jenna, who thinks she saw a UFO, that she's crazy when I say that your own eyewitness testimony is not reliable. I mean it for everybody. But for someone who doesn't have that background, that understanding of why science needs to have sort of an objective foundation, they're going to take that as saying, well, you think I'm crazy then.
And so to me, what that means is that the onus of that being effective, you know, in using that type of terminology in being able to communicate with someone is to also go deeper into explaining what it means.
But you see, there again, you've stepped into the paternalism. It's like, oh, you're just not smart enough to know what these words mean. Let me sit down and I will explain.
When I say explain, though, I also, the second point that I was going to make there is that as far as what you were saying with there being a right thing and there being a wrong thing, or there being a wrong way to understand what you're saying and a right way to understand what you're saying, although believing that the Earth is flat, you know, in our current universe, might be flat out wrong, although the belief is wrong, where that belief comes from might be a valid place to that person. So being able to come to sort of an understanding with someone and an understanding of their ideas, you don't have to agree with the ideas, but to gain an understanding of where those ideas and where those motivations are coming from and find a place in yourself to be able to consider something about this process valid, so that you can actually have a communication with someone where you don't feel that you're talking down to someone, which is always going to come across.
Of course, that also leads to another problem, is that you don't know that you are being paternalistic. I mean, like, are you coming across as paternalistic? Ideally, the person you're talking to will say, hey, listen, you know, back off, or I don't like what this or whatever that's saying. But usually when you're in discussion, or mainly when you're in a debate, you may be coming across very much of an asshole and not really realize that you're doing it. And later on, someone will come back to you and say, hey, you said this and you did this and you really shouldn't have done this. But in the heat of a discussion, and again, by the nature of a lot of the topics that we deal with on the show and skeptics do engage in, they do tend to get to be very, very heated.
Well, and it seems to me like there could be some sort of rules of debate to follow. Like, for example, if you feel that you're talking to a human being and you're looking at them and you respect them in some degree, you're probably not being paternalistic. But if you are staring at someone, picturing their head as a brick, you are probably being paternalistic.
What if you're disgusted? What if Wakefield walked in here right now?
Well, first I'd kick him in the shins. That'd be job one.
But I mean, again, depending on the situation, and you're right, for most people you deal with, you know, friends, family, people, well, maybe not your family, maybe, I don't know, you can come across in this sort of nuanced way, but lots of times you come across people, and again, there's a pinball sort of effect, where I'm sitting there, I'm going to have a debate with Ethan about the gold standard, he believes in it, I don't, and we have it's a rip-snorter, and we're being really disrespectful of each other. You are watching this, and you're going to get the opinion of, well, say my point, because obviously I'd win. you get the opinion from my point, oh, God, he was so ignorant, and he came across as so arrogant, and all that. And again, you know, you make it sound like it's really simple. Simplistic. You just need to see people as people, and all our problems would be solved, at least in theory.
Well, a lot of the things that are really important do sound really simple. For example, several months ago when we were talking about scientific communication and all kinds of, you know, is around the same subject area, about, you know, obviously consider your audience. It's a very easy thing to say and a very hard thing to apply in practice. And I think the same thing can come into these places here. It's easy to say, see someone as a person. You're like, well, whatever, they have two arms, two legs, and a head, which, by the way, not all people do, of course. They're a person. Of course I see them as a person. Of course I respect them. But really...
Well, actually, no. See, there, you don't always respect them. Because, again, some of these people, from your perspective, are bricks.
Right. And I guess what I'm saying is I believe that seeing anyone like that in the context of a debate is actually never going to get you anywhere. Because you can't talk to a brick anyway. So why are you trying?
Well, the other thing, too, is, I mean, you don't have to be in a debate to get stuck in this. You can be having a discussion. Like, you know, Don mentioned talking to, you know, a stranger. If you meet somebody at Skeptics in the Pub and you get into a heated debate, that's one thing. I find the biggest problem I have in communicating is with friends and family, because that is where a discussion that starts innocently enough can really ratchet up the intensity level, especially when you have somebody who is rejecting what you know to be sound, you know, methods for figuring things out.
And let's not forget, to again be skeptical, they are thinking the exact same thing about you. Why can't you obviously see that my anecdotal evidence is just as strong as your statistical evidence?
And what I think is really telling is what people often say actually during these moments of discussion, which is, of course, I can't believe you think X. I can't believe you think X. Why? Because you haven't taken the time to figure out why they believe X. So therefore, you can't believe it. You don't understand where it's coming from. And literally, it's a lack of understanding of each other's perspectives. And there are of course, like you were saying, some right things and some wrong things. But not addressing the reason why someone believes a wrong thing is never going to help them believe a right thing. So I think, you know, a lot of the times people trying to get a point across that they really believe in will be doing a lot more stating than questioning. And even though it might not seem super useful to probe the reasons behind something that you think are useless, it's probably a very useful tactic as far as being able to, first off, gain insight into someone and how you might be able to communicate with them better. And second off, for them to be able to trust that you think they're valid enough to ask questions of.
So let's go back to the whole original thing. So is skepticism itself somewhat inherently paternalistic? And I think in one way it kind of is, because if you follow the rules of skepticism, and ideally, and I meant to say ideally, you have learned to live a better life, as in, I know I should get vaccinated, I should go and do this. So in the one sense, it's paternalistic, as in, it is a way to tell you how to be a better person, like your parent would.
Some parents.
Right. Where we have sort of the disconnect is, it's one thing to sort of know how to live better, again, with the caveats involved, but an entirely different way to spread that knowledge to others. So skepticism itself, I think, is, in a certain degree, inherently paternalistic.
But it depends on your definition of what skepticism is, after all.
Not only that, but I want to know what these rules of skepticism are.
Well, I mean,
critical thinking.
There are people,
evidence-based,
who advocate that skepticism is a weird sort of branch of science, and it's only concerned with what is and what is not above in the universe, whether UFOs exist or they don't. It is not interested in questions of morality or society or the sort of ought side of things. Now, there are those people out there, perhaps people like P.Z. Myers or ourselves, who think that, no, skepticism is also about the ought as well. And when we're talking about, you know, sort of religious accommodation in society, that is an ought issue. When we talk about vaccination, that is an ought issue. And there are more. So to be a good skeptic, whatever that means to you, may require you to be an outspoken advocate for ideas that are not always going to be 100% popular.
And I think that nothing is, either nothing or everything is inherently paternalistic. Because there's always going to be different points of view on what is right and what is wrong. This is a point of view that, you know, lots of people, including ourselves, as far as following evidence-based science and medicine and different things like that, you know, feel really strongly about is right. But I think that what defines something as truly paternalistic and movements and stuff, and again, I sound like a broken record, but it's the style of communication that's used both within the community and to the outside world.
But I mean, you know, instructions on how to swim, for example, is not paternalistic in the same way that skepticism, almost by definition, has to be, because skepticism is about convincing people to not go to, you know, astrologers, to not go to, you know, your homeopath, to not use chiropractic. It's all about convincing people to use science-based medicine and to not get sucked in by the faith healers and to, you know, use critical thinking tools.
Right, and actually, I don't think you guys are as far apart as maybe you think, because I don't think Jenna has an issue with your points. Mm-hmm. I think where she's coming across is there's a big difference between what you believe and how you discuss that with others, mm-hmm. and that where bad skeptical paternalism isn't in, this is how we think you should live your life, because again, we think based on our own beliefs and science, which is always right, it can be true. But when you communicate skepticism in a paternalistic way, that is where you're always going to have, well, not always, but mostly you're going to have a no-win situation. Mm-hmm. Communication is the key to everything.
It pretty much is. Yes. World peace. I think that everybody, you know, on that Miss America stage should stop wishing for world peace and start wishing for better worldwide communication, from which world peace would follow.
That or the aliens.
Yeah, or time travel.
Ooh. Time travel. Actually, let's make a pact that if any of us do discover time travel...
Oh, I was really hoping you'd mention this.
Oh, that we'll come back to this moment in 10 seconds and let us know that we have discovered time travel. Are you ready?
Yep, all packed, right, go. Made.
10, 9, 8, 7.
Love that. I was so going to say that yesterday.
Okay.
It's a brilliant idea.
Well, we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so let's go to our skeptical highlights.
Ethan,
yes?
You have a skeptical highlight again?
I always have a skeptical highlight coming up.
This one.
Because it's good. It's going to be awesome. Wednesday, January 18th, 7 p.m. at the Jewish Museum and Archives of British Columbia is the Philosopher's Cafe. Bearing Witness to Witness Testimony, A Skeptic's Approach, moderated by me, Ethan. And it is free, open to all to attend. It's going to be a fantastic evening of discussing history and historic narratives.
I'm sure it will be a wonderful time, and we do. We all recommend you to go see Ethan do his thing.
And I would totally be there if I wasn't going to be on a ship getting tanned and fat.
Yeah. Well, you're doing one... Never mind. So I have a minor skeptic highlight to mention, because I understand we're going to end on a violent note. I've been doing we did a show a while ago about fracking, and actually it's been a very interesting thing that apparently BC just recently became the most fracking province in the world, that we do more fracking here than anywhere else. And for those who don't know what fracking is when you sort of do a aquatic explosion under the earth in order to free up natural gas and that sort of substance and bring it to the surface. Anyhow, the United States, very big thing about how evil it is, how horrible it is. The Canadian discussion is much different, how it's a good thing, how it's very economically wise, it's good for the economy. I think if people were interested in this, if you look at the American side, you get a very negative one. But look at the Canadian side to get that other side of the argument. I'm not a big fan of the other side, but to be a good skeptic, you should be able to see both sides. And again, I'll try and put some web links up on our show notes so that you can check that out and be informed. You need to know both sides of the argument in order to be a good skeptic.
And, you know, we should really practice some communication and making other people informed about what is good and bad as well in our own city. So, it's a new year, new rules, excellent. Less smoking areas. Woohoo! So now all our regional parks are also going to be smoke-free, as well as the city parks that have been in place for a while now. But as of January 1st, there's to be no smoking in Pacific Spirit Park and other parks under that same designation. So if you see someone who is smoking in such an area, especially if they decide to chuck a lit or unlit cigarette onto the ground, put their foot on it and assume that it has seeped into the ground never to appear again, please let them know as effectively as possible that that is just not acceptable in our beautiful city.
So, Jenna, does this extend to people who are protesting, you know, Canada's marijuana laws?
If they are within 6 meters of a window or door, have at her.
Very, very good. Alrighty then. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And Jenna, this world is amazing. The real one.
In ultraviolet light as well, real light.
True that.
Are you walking to class? Are you grabbing